sure touch, and a great heart. I wrote Premium Harmony shortly after reading more than 24 Carver stories, and it should come as no surprise that it has the feel of a Carver story. If I had written it at 20, I think it would have been no more than a blurred copy of a much better writer. Because it was written at 62, my own style bleeds through, for better or worse. Like many great American writers, Philip Roth and Jonathan Franzen come to mind, Carver seemed to have little sense of humor. I, on the other hand, see the humor in almost everything. The humor here is black, but in my opinion, that's often the best kind, because, dig it, when it comes to death, what can you do but laugh?
Premium Harmony, read by Will Patton.
They'd been married for 10 years, and for a long time everything was okay. Swell. But now they argue. Now they argue quite a lot. It's really all the same argument. It has circularity. It is, Ray sometimes thinks, like a dog track. When they argue, they're like greyhounds chasing the mechanical rabbit. You go past the same scenery time after time, but you don't see the landscape. You see the rabbit. He thinks it might be different if they'd had kids, but she couldn't have kids. They finally got tested, and that's what the doctor said. It was her problem, something in her. A year or so after that, he bought her a dog, a Jack Russell she named Biznez. B-I-Z-N-E-Z-Z. Mary would spell it for people who asked. She wants everyone to get the joke. She loves that dog. But now they argue, anyway. They're going to Walmart for grass seed. They've decided to sell the house. They can't afford to keep it, but Mary says they won't get far until they do something about the plumbing and make the lawn nice. She says those bald patches make it look shanty Irish. It's been a hot summer, with no rain to speak of. Ray tells her grass seed won't grow the lawn without rain, no matter how good the grass seed is. He says they should wait. Then another year goes by and we're still there, she says. We can't wait another year, Ray. We'll be bankrupts. When she talks, Biz looks at her from his place in the back seat. Sometimes he looks at Ray when Ray talks, but not always. Mostly, he looks at Mary. What do you think, he says? It's going to rain so you don't have to worry about going bankrupt? We're in it together, unless you forgot, she says. They're driving through Castle Rock now. It's pretty dead. What Ray calls the economy has disappeared from this part of Maine. The Walmart is on the other side of town, near the high school where Ray is a janitor. The Walmart has its own stoplight. People joke about it. Penny wise and pound foolish, he says. You ever hear that one? A million times from you. He grunts. He can see the dog in the rearview mirror watching her. Sometimes he hates the way Biz does that. It comes to him that neither of them knows what they are talking about. It is a depressing thought. And pull in at the Quick Pick, she says. I want to get a kickball for Tally's birthday. Tally is her brother's little girl. Ray supposes that makes her his niece, although he's not sure that's right since all the blood is on Mary's side. They have balls at Walmart, Ray says, and everything's cheaper at Wally World.
The ones at Quick Pick are purple. Purple is her favorite color. I can't be sure there'll be purple at Walmart.
If there aren't, we'll stop at the Quick Pick on the way back. He feels like a great weight is pressing down on his head. She'll get her way. She always does on things like this. Marriage is like a football game, and he's quarterbacking the underdog team. He has to pick his spots, make short passes.
It'll be on the wrong side coming back, she says, as if they are caught in a torrent of city traffic instead of rolling through an almost deserted little town where most of the stores are for sale. I'll just dash in and get the ball and dash right back out.
At 200 pounds, Ray thinks, your dashing days are over, honey.
They're only 99 cents, she says. Don't be such a pinch penny.
Don't be so pound foolish, he thinks, but what he says is,
Buy me a pack of smokes while you're in there. I'm out. If you quit, we'd have an extra $40 a week.
He saves up and pays a friend in South Carolina to ship him a dozen cartons at a time. They're $20 a carton cheaper in South Carolina. That's a lot of money even in this day and age. It's not like he doesn't try to economize. He has told her this before and will again, but what's the point? In one ear, out the other. Nothing to slow down what he says in the middle.
I used to smoke 2 packs a day, he says. Now I smoke less than half a pack.
Actually, most days he smokes more. She knows it, and Ray knows she knows it. That's marriage after a while. That weight on his head gets a little heavier. Also, he can see Biz still looking at her. He feeds the damn thing, and he makes the money that pays for the food, but it's her she's looking at. And Jack Russells are supposed to be smart. He turns into the quick pick.
You ought to buy them on Indian Island if you've got to have them, she says.
They haven't sold tax-free smokes on the res for 10 years, he says. I've told you that, too. You don't listen. He pulls past the gas pumps and parks beside the store. There's no shade. The sun is directly overhead. The car's air conditioner only works a little. They are both sweating. In the back seat, Biz is panting. It makes him look like he's grinning.
Well, you ought to quit, Mary says. And you ought to quit those little Debbies, he says.
He doesn't want to say this. He knows how sensitive she is about her weight, but out it comes. He can't hold it back. It's a mystery.
I ain't had one in a year, she says. Mary, the box is on the top shelf, a 24-pack behind the flower. Were you snooping? She cries.
A flush is rising in her cheeks, and he sees how she looked when she was still beautiful. Good-looking, anyway. Everybody said she was good-looking, even his mother, who didn't like her otherwise.
I was looking for the bottle opener, he says. I had a bottle of cream soda, the kind with the old-fashioned cap. Looking for a bottle opener on the top shelf of the goddamn cupboard.
Go in and get the ball, he says, and get me some smokes. Be a sport.
Can't you wait until we get home? Can't you even wait that long?
You can get the cheap ones, he says. That off-brand, Premium Harmony, they're called. They taste like old stale cow shit, but all right. If she'll only shut up about it, it's too hot to argue.
Where are you going to smoke, anyway? In the car, I suppose, so I have to breathe it.
I'll open the window, I always do.
I'll get the ball, then I'll come back. If you feel you have to spend $4.50 to poison your lungs, you can go in. I'll sit with the baby.
Ray hates it when she calls Biz the baby. He's a dog. And he may be as bright as Mary likes to boast, but he still shits outside and licks where his balls used to be.
Buy a few Twinkies while you're at it, he tells her. Or maybe they're having a special on Ho-Ho's. You're so mean, she says.
She gets out of the car and slams the door.
He's parked too close to the concrete cube of a building, and she has to sidle until she's past the trunk of the car.
And he knows she knows he's looking at her, seeing how she's now so big she has to sidle.
He knows she thinks he parked close to the building on purpose to make her sidle.
And maybe he did. He wants a cigarette.
Well, Biz, old buddy, it's just you and me.
Biz lies down on the back seat and closes his eyes. He may get up on his back paws and shuffle around for a few seconds when Mary puts on a record and tells him to dance. And if she tells him, in a jolly voice, that he's a bad boy, he may go into the corner and sit facing the wall. But he still shits outside. The time goes by, and she doesn't come out. Ray opens the glove compartment. He paws through the rat's nest of papers looking for some cigarettes he might have forgotten, but there aren't any. He does find the Hostess Snowball still in his wrapper. He pokes it. It's as stiff as a corpse. It's got to be 1,000 years old. Maybe older. Maybe it came over on the Ark.
Everybody has his poison, he says. He unwraps the snowball and tosses it into the back seat. Want this, Biz? Go ahead, knock yourself out.
Biz snarks the snowball in 2 bites. Then he sets to work licking up bits of coconut off the seat. Mary would have a shit fit, but Mary's not here. Ray looks at the gas gauge and sees it's down to half. He could turn off the motor and unroll the windows, but then he'd really bake. sitting here in the sun, waiting for her to buy a purple plastic kickball for 99 cents when he knows they could get one for 79 cents at Walmart. Only that one might be yellow or red. Not good enough for Tally, only purple for the princess. He sits there and Mary doesn't come back. "Christ on a pony," he says. Cool air traces over his face. He thinks again about turning off the engine, saving some gas, then thinks, fuck it. She won't bring him the smokes either. Not even the cheap off-brand. This he knows. He had to make that crack about those little Debbies. He sees a young woman in the rearview mirror. She's jogging toward the car. She's even heavier than Mary. Great big tits shuffle back and forth under a blue smock. Biz sees her coming and starts to bark. Ray unrolls the window.
"Is your wife a blonde-haired woman?"
She puffs the words.
"A blonde-haired woman wearing sneakers?"
Her face shines with sweat. "Yes, she wanted a ball for our niece."
"Well, something's wrong with her. She fell down. She's unconscious. Mr. Gosh says he thinks she might have had a heart attack. He called 911. You better come."
Ray locks the car and follows her into the store. It's cold inside after the car. Mary is lying on the floor with her legs spread and her arms at her sides. She's next to a wire cylinder full of kickballs. The sign over the wire cylinder says, "Hot fun in the summertime." Her eyes are closed. She might be sleeping there on the linoleum floor. Three people are standing over her. One is a dark-skinned man in khaki pants and a white shirt. A name tag on the pocket of his shirt says, "Mr. Gosh, manager." The other two are customers. One is a thin old man without much hair. He's in his 70s, at least. The other's a fat woman. She's fatter than Mary. Fatter than the girl in the blue smock, too. Ray thinks by rights she's the one who should be lying out on the floor.
"Sir, are you this lady's husband?" Mr. Gosh asks.
"Yes," Ray says. "That doesn't seem to be enough." "I sure am."
"I am sorry to say, but I think she might be dead," Mr. Gosh says. "I gave the artificial respiration and the mouth-to-mouth, but..."
He shrugs. Ray thinks of the dark-skinned man putting his mouth on Mary's, Frenching her, sort of, breathing down her throat right next to the wire cylinder full of plastic kickballs. Then he kneels down. "Mary," he says. "Mary!" Like trying to wake her up after a hard night. She doesn't appear to be breathing, but you can't always tell. He puts his ear by her mouth and he has nothing. He feels air moving on his skin, but that's probably just the air conditioning.
"This gentleman called 911, the fat woman says. She's holding a bag of bugles.
"Mary!" Ray says, louder this time. But he can't quite bring himself to shout, not down on his knees with people standing around, one of them a dark-skinned man. He looks up and says, apologetically, "She never gets sick. She's healthy as a horse."
"You never know," the old man says. He shakes his head.
"She just fell down," says the young woman in the blue smock. "Didn't say a word."
"Did she grab her chest?" asks the fat woman with the bugles.
"I don't know," the young woman says. "I guess not. Not that I saw. She just fell down."
There's a rack of souvenir T-shirts near the kickballs. They say things like, "My parents were treated like royalty in Castle Rock, and all I got was this lousy T-shirt." Mr. Gosh takes one and says,
"Would you like me to cover her face, sir?"
"God, no," Ray says, startled. "She might only be unconscious. We're not doctors." Past Mr. Gosh, he sees three kids, teenagers, looking in the window. One of them is taking pictures with his cell phone. Mr. Gosh looks where Ray's looking and rushes at the door, flapping his hands. "You kids get out of here! You kids get out!" Laughing, the teenagers shuffle backwards, then turn and jog past the gas pumps to the sidewalk. Beyond them, the nearly deserted downtown shimmers. A car goes by, pulsing rap. To Ray, the bass sounds like Mary's stolen heartbeat.
"Where's the ambulance?" the old man says. "How come it's not here yet?"
Ray kneels by his wife while the time goes by. His back hurts, and his knees hurt, but if he gets up, he'll look like a spectator. The ambulance turns out to be a Chevy Suburban painted white with orange stripes. The red jackpot lights are flashing. Castle County Rescue is printed across the front, only backwards, so you can read it in your rearview mirror. Ray thinks that's pretty clever. The two men who come in are dressed in white. They look like waiters. One pushes an oxygen tank on a dolly. It's a green tank with an American flag decal on it.
"Sorry," this one says. "Just cleared a car accident over in Oxford."
The other one sees Mary lying on the floor, legs spread, hands to her sides.
"Aw, gee," he says.
Ray can't believe it. "Is she still alive?" he asks. "Is she just unconscious? If she is, you better give her oxygen or she'll have brain damage." Mr. Gosh shakes his head. The young woman in the blue smock starts to cry. Ray wants to ask her what she's crying about, then knows. She has made up a whole story about him from what he just said. Why, if he came back in a week or so and played his cards right, she might toss him a mercy fuck. Not that he would, but he sees that maybe he could, if he wanted to. Mary's eyes don't react to a pin light. One EMT listens to her non-existent heartbeat, and the other takes her non-existent blood pressure. It goes on like that for a while. The teenagers come back with some of their friends. Other people, too. Ray guesses they're drawn by the flashing red lights on top of the EMT Suburban the way bugs are drawn to a porch light. Mr. Gosh runs at them again, flapping his arms. They back away again. Then, when Mr. Gosh returns to the circle around Mary and Ray, they come back and start looking in again. One of the EMTs says to Ray,
"She was your wife?"
"Right."
"Well, sir, I'm sorry to say that she's dead."
"Oh." Ray stands up. His knees crack. "They told me she was, but I wasn't sure."
"Mary, Mother of God, bless her soul,"
says the fat lady with the bugles. She crosses herself. Mr. Gosh offers one of the EMTs the souvenir T-shirt to put over Mary's face, but the EMT shakes his head and goes outside. He tells the little crowd that there's nothing to see, as if anyone's going to believe a dead woman in the quick pick isn't interesting. The EMT pulls a gurney from the back of the rescue vehicle. He does it with a single quick flip of the wrist. The legs fold down all by themselves. The old man with the thinning hair holds the door open and the EMT pulls his rolling deathbed inside.
"Whew, hot," the EMT says, wiping his forehead.
"You may want to turn away for this part, sir," the other one says.
But Ray watches as they lift her onto the gurney. A sheet has been neatly folded down at the end of the gurney. They pull it all the way up until it's over her face. Now Mary looks like a corpse in a movie. They roll her out into the heat. This time it's the fat woman with the bugles who holds the door for them. The crowd has retreated to the sidewalk. There must be 36 standing in the unrelieved August sunshine. When Mary is stored, the EMTs come back. One is holding a clipboard. He asks Ray about 25 questions. Ray can answer all but the one about her age. Then he remembers she's 3 years younger than he is and tells him 34.
"We're going to take her to St. Stevie's," the EMT with the clipboard says. "You can follow us if you don't know where that is."
"I know," Ray says. "What, do you want to do an autopsy? Cut her up?"
The girl in the blue smock gives a gasp. Mr. Gosh puts his arm around her and she puts her face against his white shirt. Ray wonders if Mr. Gosh is fucking her. He hopes not. Not because of Mr. Gosh's brown skin, Ray doesn't care about that, but because he's got to be twice her age. An older man can take advantage, especially when he's the boss.
"Well, that's not our decision," the EMT says. "But probably not. She didn't die unattended."
"I'll say,"
the woman with the bugles interjects. "And it's pretty clearly a heart attack. You can probably have her released to the mortuary almost immediately."
"Mortuary? An hour ago they were in a car, arguing." "I don't have a mortuary," he says. "Not a mortuary, a burial plot, nothing. Why the hell would I? She's 34.
The two EMTs exchange a look. "Mr. Burkett, There'll be someone to help you with all that at St. Stevie's. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry? What the hell?
The EMT wagon pulls out with the lights still flashing but the siren off. The crowd on the sidewalk starts to break up. The counter girl, the old man, the fat woman, and Mr. Gosh look at Ray as though he's someone special, a celebrity. She wanted a purple kickball for our niece, he says. She's having a birthday. She'll be 8. Her name's Tally. She was named for an actress. Mr. Gosh takes a purple kickball from the wire rack and holds it out to Ray in both hands. On the house, he says. Thank you, sir, Ray says. The woman with the bugles bursts into tears. Mary, Mother of God, she says. They stand around for a while, talking. Mr. Gosh gets sodas from the cooler. These are also in the house. They drink their sodas, and Ray tells them a few things about Mary, steering clear of the arguments. He tells them how she made a quilt that took 3rd prize at the Castle County Fair. That was in 02, or maybe 03. That's so sad, the woman with the bugle says. She has opened them and shared them around. They eat and drink. My wife went in her sleep, the old man with the thinning hair says. She just laid down on the sofa and never woke up. We were married 37 years. I always expected I'd go first, but that's not the way God wanted it. I can still see her laying there on the sofa. He shakes his head. I couldn't believe it. Finally, Ray runs out of things to tell them, and they run out of things to tell him. Customers are coming in again. Mr. Gosh waits on some, and the woman in the blue smock waits on others. Then the fat woman says she really has to go. She gives Ray a kiss on the cheek before she does. You need to see to your business, Mr. Burkett, she tells him. Her tone is both reprimanding and flirtatious. Ray thinks she might be another mercy fuck possibility. He looks at the clock over the counter. It's the kind with a beer advertisement on it. Almost 2 hours have gone by since Mary went sidling between the car and the cinder block side of the quick pick. And for the first time he thinks of Biz. When he opens the door, heat rushes out at him, and when he puts his hand on the steering wheel to lean in, he pulls it back with a cry. It's got to be 130 in there. Biz is dead on his back. His eyes are milky. His tongue is protruding from the side of his mouth. Ray can see the wink of his teeth. There are little bits of coconut caught in his whiskers. That shouldn't be funny, but it is. Not funny enough to laugh, but funny in a way that's some fancy word he can't quite think of. Biz, old buddy, he says, I'm sorry. I forgot all about you. Great sadness and amusement sweep over him as he looks at the baked Jack Russell. That anything so sad should still be funny is just a crying shame. Well, you're with her now, ain't you? He says, and his thought is so sad, yet so sweet, that he begins to cry. It's a hard storm. While he's crying, it comes to him that now he can smoke all he wants, and anywhere in the house. He can smoke right there at her dining room table. You're with her now, Biz, old buddy, he says through his tears. His voice is clogged and thick. It's a relief to sound just right for the situation. Poor old Mary. Poor old Biz. Damn it all. Still crying, and with the purple kickball still tucked under his arm, he goes back into the quick pick. He tells Mr. Gosh he forgot to get cigarettes. He thinks maybe Mr. Gosh will give him a pack of premium harmonies on the house as well. But Mr. Gosh's generosity doesn't stretch that far. Ray smokes all the way to the hospital with the windows shut and Biz in the back seat and the air conditioning on high.
Thinking of Raymond Carver. Sometimes a story arrives complete, a done thing. Usually, though, they come to me in two parts, first the cup, then the handle. Because the handle may not show up for weeks, months, or even years, I have a little box in the back of my mind full of unfinished cups, each protected in that unique mental packing we call memory. You can't go looking for a handle, no matter how beautiful the cup may be. You have to wait for it to appear. I realize that metaphor sort of sucks, but when you're talking about the process we call creative writing, most of them do. I have written fiction all my life and still have very little understanding of how the process works. Of course, I don't understand how my liver works either, but as long as it keeps doing its job, I'm good with that. About 6 years ago, I saw a near-miss accident at a busy intersection in Sarasota. A cowboy driver tried to wedge his Bigfoot truck, the kind with the huge tires, into a left turn lane already occupied by another Bigfoot truck. The guy whose space was being encroached upon hit his horn. There was a predictable screech of brakes, and the two gas-guzzling behemoths ended up inches apart. The guy in the turn lane unrolled his window and raised one finger to the blue Florida sky in a salute that is as American as baseball. The fellow who had almost hit him returned the greeting along with a Tarzan chest thump that presumably meant, "Do you want a piece of me?" Then the light turned green, other drivers began to honk, and they went on their way with no physical confrontation. The incident got me thinking about what might have happened if the two drivers had emerged from their vehicles and started duking it out right there on the Tamiami Trail. Not an unreasonable imagining. Road rage happens all the time. Unfortunately, it happens all the time is not a recipe for a good story. Yet that near accident stuck with me. It was a cup with no handle. A year or so later, while eating lunch in an Applebee's with my wife, I saw a man in his 50s cutting up an elderly gent's chopped steak. He did it carefully while the elderly gent stared vacantly over his head. At one point, the old guy seemed to come around a little and tried to grab the utensils, presumably so he could attend to his own meal. The younger man smiled and shook his head. The elderly gent let go and resumed his staring. I decided they were father and son, and there it was, the handle for my road rage cup.
Batman and Robin have an altercation. Read by Santino Fontana.
Sanderson sees his father twice a week. On Wednesday evenings, after he closes the jewelry store his parents opened long ago, he drives the 3 miles to Cracker Jack Manor and sees Pop there, usually in the common room. In his suite, if Pop is having a bad day. On most Sundays, Sanderson takes him out to lunch. The facility where Pop is living out his final foggy years is actually called the Harvest Hills Special Care Unit. But to Sanderson, Cracker Jack Manor seems more accurate. Their time together isn't actually so bad, and not just because Sanderson no longer has to change the old man's bed when he pisses in it, or get up in the middle of the night when Pop goes wandering around the house, calling for his wife to make him some scrambled eggs, or telling Sanderson those damned Fredericks boys are out in the backyard, drinking and hollering at each other. Dory Sanderson has been dead for 15 years, and the 3 Fredericks boys, no longer boys, moved away long ago. There's an old joke about Alzheimer's. The good news is that you meet new people every day. Sanderson has discovered the real good news is that the script rarely changes. It means you almost never have to improvise. Applebee's, for instance, although they have been having Sunday lunch at the same one for over 3 years now, Pop almost always says the same thing. "This isn't so bad. We ought to come here again." He always has chopped steak, done medium rare, and when the bread pudding comes, he tells Sanderson that his wife's bread pudding is better. Last year, the pudding was off the menu of the Applebee's on Commerce Way, so Pop, after having Sanderson read the dessert choices to him 4 times and thinking it over for an endless 2 minutes, ordered the apple cobbler. When it came, Pop said that Dory served hers with heavy cream. Then he simply sat, staring out the window at the highway. The next time, he made the same observation, but ate the cobbler right down to the china. He can usually be counted on to remember Sanderson's name and the relationship, but he sometimes calls Sanderson Reggie, the name of his older brother. Reggie died 40 years ago. When Sanderson prepares to leave the suite on Wednesdays, or on Sundays after he takes his father back to Cracker Jack Manor, his father invariably thanks him and promises that next time he will be feeling better. In his young years, before meeting Dory Levin, who civilized him, Sanderson's pop-to-be was a roughneck in the Texas oil fields, and sometimes he reverts to that man, who never dreamed he would one day become a successful jewelry merchant in San Antonio. On these occasions, he is confined to his suite, once he turned his bed over and paid for his efforts with a broken wrist. When the orderly on duty, Jose, Pop's favorite, asked why he did it, Pop said it was because that fucking Gunton wouldn't turn down his radio. There is no Gunton, of course. Not now. Somewhere in the past, maybe. Probably. Lately, Pop has displayed a kleptomaniacal streak. The orderlies, nurses, and doctors have found all sorts of things in his room. Vases, plastic utensils from the dining hall, the TV controller from the common room. Once, Jose discovered an El Producto cigar box, filled with various jigsaw puzzle pieces and 80 or 90 assorted playing cards under Pop's bed. Pop cannot tell anyone, including his son, why he takes these things, and usually denies that he has taken them at all. Once he told Sanderson that Gunderson was trying to get him in trouble. "Do you mean Gunton, Pop?" Sanderson asked. Pop waved a bony driftwood hand. "All that guy ever wanted was pussy. He was the original pussy hound from Pussyville." But the klepto phase seems to be passing. That's what Jose says, anyway. And this Sunday, his father is calm enough. It's not one of his clear days, but not one of the really bad ones, either. It's good enough for Applebee's. And if they get through it without his father pissing himself, all will be well. He's wearing continence pants, but of course, there's a smell. For this reason, Sanderson always gets them a corner table. That's not a problem. They dine at 2, and by then the after-church crowd is back home, watching baseball or football on TV. "Who are you?" Pop asks in the car. It's a bright day, but chilly. In his oversized sunglasses and wool topcoat, he looks quite a lot like Uncle Junior, that old gangster from The Sopranos. "I'm Dougie," Sanderson says. "Your son."
"I remember Dougie," Pop says. "But he died."
"No, Pop, uh-uh. Reggie died. He..."
Sanderson trails off, waiting to see if Pop will finish. Pop doesn't.
"It was an accident."
"Drunk, was he?"
Pop asks. This hurts, even after all the years. That's the bad news about what his father has. He is capable of random cruelties that, while unmeant, can still sting like hell.
"No," Sanderson said. "That was a kid who hit him, and then walked away with nothing but a couple of scratches. That kid will be in his 50s now, probably going silver at the temples."
Sanderson hopes this grown version of the kid who killed his brother has scoliosis. He hopes the guy's wife died of ovarian cancer. Hopes he got mumps and went both blind and sterile. But he's probably just fine, managing a grocery store somewhere. Maybe even, God help them, managing an Applebee's. Why not? He was 16, all water over the dam, youthful indiscretion. The records would be sealed, and Reggie, also sealed. Bones inside a suit under a headstone on Mission Hill. Some days Sanderson can't even remember what he looked like.
"Dougie and I used to play Batman and Robin," Pop says. "It was his favorite game."
They stop for the light at the intersection of Commerce Way and Airline Road, where trouble will soon occur. Sanderson looks at his father and smiles,
Yeah, Pop, good. We even went out that way for Halloween one year, do you remember? I talked you into it. The Caped Crusader and the Boy Wonder. His Pop looks out through the windshield of Sanderson's Subaru, saying nothing. What is he thinking? Or his thought flattened to nothing but a carrier wave? Sanderson sometimes imagines the sound that flatline might make. Like the old test pattern hum on TV, back before cable and satellite. Sanderson puts his hand on one thin, top-coated arm and gives it a friendly squeeze. You were drunk on your ass and Mom was mad, but I had fun. That was my best Halloween. I never drink around my wife, Pop says. No, Sanderson thinks as the light turns green. Not once she trained you out of it. Want help with the menu, Pop? I can read, his father says. He no longer can, but it's bright in their corner and he can look at the pictures even with his Uncle Junior gangsta sunglasses on. Besides, Sanderson knows what he will order. When the waiter comes with their iced teas, Pop says he'll have the chopped steak, medium rare. I want it pink, but not red, he says. If it's red, I'll send it back. The waiter nods.
Your usual.
Pop looks at him suspiciously.
Green beans or coleslaw?
Pop snorts. You kidding? All those beans were dead. You couldn't sell costume jewelry that year, let alone the real stuff.
He'll have the slaw, Sanderson says. And I'll have... All those beans were dead,
Pop says emphatically, gives the waiter an imperious look that says, do you dare challenge me? The waiter, who has served them many times before, merely nods and says,
they were dead,
before turning to Sanderson.
For you, sir?
They eat. Pop refuses to take off his top coat, so Sanderson asks for one of the plastic bibs and ties it around his father's neck. Pop makes no objection to this, may not register it at all. Some of his slaw ends up on his pants, but the bib catches most of the mushroom gravy drips. As they are finishing, Pop informs the mostly empty room that he has to piss so bad he can taste it. Sanderson accompanies him to the men's room, and his father allows him to unzip his fly. But when Sanderson attempts to pull down the elasticized front of the continence pants, Pop slaps his hand away.
Never handle another man's meat, Sonny Jim, he says annoyed. Don't you know that?
This prompts an ancient memory. Dougie Sanderson standing in front of the toilet with his shorts puddled around his feet and his father kneeling beside him, giving instruction. How old was he then? 3? Only 2? Yes, maybe only 2. But he doesn't doubt the recollection. It's like a fleck of bright glass seen at the side of the road, one so perfectly positioned it leaves an afterimage.
Unlimber, assume the position, fire when ready, he says.
Pop gives him a suspicious look, then breaks Sanderson's heart with a grin.
I used to tell my boys that when I was getting them house broke, he says. Dory told me it was my job. And I did it, by God.
He unleashes a torrent, and most of it actually goes into the urinal. The smell is sour and sugary. Diabetes. But what does that matter? Sometimes Sanderson thinks the sooner the better. Back at their table, still wearing the bib, Pop renders his verdict.
This place ain't so bad. We ought to come here again.
How about some dessert, Pop?
Pop considers the idea, gazing out the window, mouth hanging open. Or is it only the carrier wave? No, not this time.
Why not? I have room.
They both order the apple cobbler. Pop regards the scoop of vanilla on top with his eyebrows pulled together into a thicket.
My wife used to serve this with heavy cream. Her name was Dory, short for Doreen. Like on the Mickey Mouse Club. Hi there, ho there, hey there, you're as welcome as can be.
I know, Pop. Eat up.
Are you Dougie?
Yeah.
Really? Not pulling my leg?
No, Pop. I'm Dougie.
His father holds up a dripping spoonful of ice cream and apples.
We did, didn't we?
Did what?
Went out trick-and-treating as Batman and Robin.
Sanderson laughs, surprised. We sure did. Ma said I was born foolish, but you had no excuse. And Reggie wouldn't come near us. He was disgusted by the whole thing.
I was drunk, Pop says,
then begins eating his dessert. When he finishes, he belches, points out the window, and says,
Look at those birds. What are they again?
Sanderson looks. The birds are clustered on a dumpster in the parking lot. Several more are on the fence behind it. They're crows, Pop.
Christ, I know that,
Pop says.
Crows never bothered us back then. We had a pellet gun. Now listen.
He leans forward, all business.
Have we been here before?
Sanderson briefly considers the metaphysical possibilities inherent in this question, then says, Yes, we come here most Sundays.
Well, it's a good place, but I think we ought to go back. I'm tired.
I want that other thing now.
A nap.
That other thing, Pop says, giving him that imperious look. Sanderson motions for the check, and while he's paying it at the register, Pop sails on with his hands tucked deep in his coat pockets. Sanderson grabs his change in a hurry and has to run to catch the door before Pop can wander out into the parking lot, or even into the busy four lanes of Commerce Way.
That was a good night,
Pop says as Sanderson buckles his seatbelt.
What night was that? Halloween, you dummy. You were 8. So it was 1959. You were born in 51.
Sanderson looks at his father, amazed. But the old man is staring straight ahead at the traffic. Sanderson closes the passenger door, goes around the hood of his Subaru, gets in behind the wheel. They say nothing for 2 or 3 blocks, and Sanderson assumes his father has forgotten the whole thing. But he hasn't.
When we got to the Forrester's house at the bottom of the hill, you remember the hill, don't you?
Church Street Hill? Sure.
Right. Norma Forrester opened the door, and to you she says, before you could, she says, trick or treat. Then she looks at me and says, trick or drink?
Pop makes a rusty hinge sound that Sanderson hasn't heard in a year or more. He even slaps his thigh.
Trick or drink? What a card. You remember that, don't you?
Sanderson tries, but comes up empty. All he remembers is how happy he was to have his dad with him. Even though Dad's Batman costume, put together on the fly, was pretty lame. Gray pajamas, the bat emblem drawn on the front with magic marker, the cape cut out of an old bedsheet, the Batman utility belt was a leather belt in which his father had stuck an assortment of screwdrivers and chisels, even an adjustable wrench, from the toolbox in the garage. The mask was a moth-eaten balaclava that Pop rolled up to the nose so his mouth showed. Standing in front of the hallway mirror, before going out, he pulled the top of the mask up on the sides, plucking at it to make ears. But they wouldn't stay.
She offered me a bottle of Shiners, Pop says.
Now they're 9 blocks up Commerce Way and approaching the intersection at Airline Road. Did you take it? Pop is on a roll. Sanderson would love for it to continue all the way back to Cracker Jack Manor.
Sure did.
He falls silent. As Commerce Way approaches the intersection, the 2 lanes become 3. The one on the far left is a turn lane. The lights for straight-ahead traffic are red, but the one handling traffic in the left turn lane is showing a green arrow.
That gal had tits like pillows. She was the best lovin' I ever had.
Yes, they hurt you. Sanderson knows this not just from his own experience, but from talking to others who have relatives in the manor. Mostly they don't mean to, but they do. What memories remain to them are all in a jumble, like the pilfered puzzle pieces Jose found in the cigar box under Pop's bed. And there's no governor on them, no way of separating stuff that's okay to talk about from the stuff that isn't.
Sanderson has never had a reason to think his father was anything but faithful to his wife for the entire 40-some years of their marriage. But isn't that an assumption all grown children make? If their parents' marriage was serene and collegial? He takes his eyes off the road to look at his father. And that is why there is an accident instead of one of the near misses that happen all the time on busy roads like Commerce Way. Even so, it's not a terribly serious one, and though Sanderson knows his attention wandered from the road for a second or two, he also knows it still wasn't his fault. One of those built-up pickup trucks with the oversized tires and the roof lights on the cab swerves into his lane, wanting to get all the way left in time to turn before the green arrow goes out. There's no taillight blinker. This Sanderson notes just as the left front of his Subaru collides with the rear of the pickup truck. He and his father are both thrown forward into their locked seatbelts, and a ridge suddenly heaves up in the middle of his Subaru's previously smooth hood. But the airbags don't deploy. There's a brisk tinkle of glass. "Asshole!" Sanderson cries. "Jesus!" Then he makes a mistake. He pushes the button that unrolls his window, sticks out his arm, and wags his middle finger at the truck. Later, he will think he only did it because Pop was in the car with him, and Pop was on a roll. "Pop," Sanderson turns to him. "You okay?"
"What happened?" Pop says. "Why'd we quit?"
He's confused, but otherwise fine. A good thing he was wearing his seatbelt, although God knows it's hard to forget them these days. The cars won't let you. Drive 50 feet without putting one on, and they begin screaming with indignation. Sanderson leans over Pop's lap, thumbs open the glove compartment, gets out his registration and insurance card. When he straightens up again, the door of the pickup truck is standing open and the driver is walking toward him, taking absolutely no notice of the cars that honk and swerve to get around the latest fender bender. There isn't as much traffic as there would be on a weekday, but Sanderson doesn't count this as a blessing, because he's looking at the approaching driver and thinking, "I could be in trouble here." He knows this guy. Not personally, but he's a South Texas staple. He's wearing jeans and a t-shirt with the sleeves ripped off at the shoulders. Not cut, ripped, so that errant strings dangle against the tan slabs of muscle on his upper arms. The jeans are hanging off his hip bones so the brand name of his underwear shows. A chain runs from one beltless loop of his jeans to his back pocket, where there will no doubt be a big leather wallet, possibly embossed with the logo of a heavy metal band. Lots of ink on his arms and hands, even crawling up his neck. This is the kind of guy, when Sanderson sees him on the sidewalk outside his jewelry shop via closed-circuit TV, who causes him to push the button that locks the door. Right now, he would like to push the button that locks his car door, but of course, he can't do that. He should never have flipped the guy the bird, and he even had time to rethink his options, because he had to roll down the window in order to do it. But it's too late now. Sanderson opens the door and gets out, ready to be placating, to apologize for what he shouldn't need to apologize for. It was the guy who cut across, for God's sake. But here is something else. Something that makes little quills of dismay prickle the skin of his forearms and the back of his neck, which is sweating now that he's out of the AC. The guy's tattoos are crude, straggling things. Chains around the biceps. Thorns circling the forearms. A dagger on one wrist with a drop of blood hanging from the tip of the blade. No skin shop did those. That's jailhouse ink. Tatman is at least 6'2 in his boots, and at least 200 pounds, maybe 220. Sanderson is 5'9 and weighs 160. "Look, I'm sorry I flipped you the bird," Sanderson says. "Heat of the moment, but you changed lanes without—"
"Look what you did to my truck," Tatman says. "I ain't had it but 3 months.
"We need to exchange insurance information. They also need a cop." Sanderson looks around for one and sees only rubberneckers, slowing down to assess the damage and then speeding up again.
"You think I got insurance when I can barely make the payments on that bitch?"
"You have to have insurance," Sanderson thinks. "It's the law." Only a guy like this doesn't think he has to have anything.
The rubber testicles hanging under his license plate are the final proof.
Why the fuck didn't you let me in, asshole?
There was no time, Sanderson said. You cut across. You never blinked.
I blinked.
Then how come it isn't on? Sanderson points.
Because you knocked out my fucking taillight, nummy. How am I supposed to tell my girlfriend about this? She fronted the fucking down payment, and get that fucking shit out of my face.
He strikes the insurance card and registration, which Sanderson is still holding out from Sanderson's hand. Sanderson looks down at them, stunned. His papers are lying on the road.
I'm going, Tapman says. I'll fix my damage. You fix yours. That's how it's gonna work.
The damage to the Subaru is far worse than the damage to the absurdly oversized pickup, probably 1,500 or 2,000 more. But that isn't what makes Sanderson speak up. It isn't being afraid the lug will get away clean, either. All Sanderson has to do is write down the number of the plate above those hanging rubber testes. It isn't even the heat, which is whopping. It's the thought of his gorked-out father sitting there in the passenger seat, not knowing what's happening, needing a nap. They should be halfway back to Cracker Jack Manor by now, but no. No. Because this happy asshole had to cut across traffic. Just had to scoot under that green arrow before it went out, or the world would grow dark and the winds of judgment would blow.
That's not how it's gonna work, Sanderson says. It was your fault. You cut in front of me without signaling. I didn't have time to stop. I want to see your registration, and I want to see your driver's license.
Fuck your mother, the big man says, and punches Sanderson in the stomach. Sanderson bends over, expelling all the air in his lungs in a great whoosh. He should have known better than to provoke the driver of the pickup truck. He did know better. One look at those amateur tats and anyone would have known better. But he still went ahead because he didn't believe this would happen in broad daylight at the intersection of Commerce Way and Airline Road. He belongs to the Jaycees. He hasn't been punched since the third grade, when the argument was over baseball cards.
That there's my registration, Tapman says.
Big streams of sweat are running down the sides of his face.
I hope you like it. As for my driver's license, I don't have one, okay? Fucking don't. I'm gonna be in a lot of trouble, and it's all your fucking fault because you were jerking off instead of looking where you were going. Fucking ring me.
Then Tapman loses it completely. Maybe it's the accident, maybe it's the heat, maybe it's Sanderson's insistence on looking at documents Tapman doesn't have. It might even be the sound of his own voice. Sanderson has heard the phrase, he lost it, many times, but realizes he has never taken in its full meaning until now. Tatman is his teacher, and he's a good teacher. He laces both of his hands together, making a double fist. Sanderson has just enough time to see there are blue eyes on Tatman's knuckles before he's hit in the side of the face with a sledgehammer that drives him back against the newly distressed right side of his car. He slides along it, feeling a prong of metal tear his shirt and the skin beneath. Blood spills down his side, hot as fever. Then his knees buckle and he lands on the road. He stares down at his hands, not believing they are his hands. His right cheek is hot and seems to be rising like bread dough. His right eye is watering. Next comes a kick to his wounded side, just above the belt line. Sanderson's head hits the right front hubcap of his Subaru and bounces off. He tries to crawl out from under Tatman's shadow. Tatman is yelling at him, but Sanderson can't make out any words. It's just wah, 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 the sound adults make when they're talking to the kids in the animated Peanuts cartoons. He wants to tell Tatman, okay, okay, you say tomato and I say tomato. Let's call the whole thing off. He wants to say no harm and no foul, although he feels he has been fouled quite badly. You go your way and I'll go mine. Happy trails to you. See you tomorrow, Mouseketeers. Only he can't catch his breath. He thinks he's gonna have a heart attack, maybe having one already. He wants to raise his head. If he's gonna die, he would like to do it looking at something more interesting than the surface of Commerce Way and the front of his own wounded car. But he can't seem to do it.
His neck has become a noodle. There's another kick, this time in the high meat of his left thigh. Then Tatman gives a guttural cry, and red drops begin to splash the composition surface of the roadway. Sanderson at first thinks it's his nose, or maybe his lips from the double-handed blow to his face. But then more warmth splashes the back of his neck. It's like a tropical rain shower. He crawls a little farther, past the hood of his car, then manages to turn over and sit. He looks up, squinting against the dazzle of the sky, and sees Pop standing beside Tatman. Tatman is bent over like a man suffering serious stomach cramps. He is also groping at the side of his neck, which has sprouted a piece of wood. At first, Sanderson can't understand what has happened, but then he gets it. The piece of wood is the handle of a knife, one he's seen before. He sees it almost every week. You don't need a steak knife to cut the kind of chopped meat Pop always has at their Sunday lunches. A fork does the trick very nicely, but they bring you a knife anyway. It's all part of Applebee's service. Pop may no longer remember which son comes to visit him, or that his wife is dead. He probably no longer even remembers his middle name, but it seems he hasn't lost all the clever ruthlessness that enabled him to rise from a no-college oil fields roughneck to an upper-middle-class jewelry merchant in San Antonio. He got me to look at the birds, Sanderson thinks. The crows on the dumpster. That's when he took the knife. Tatman has lost interest in the man sitting in the road and never casts a single glance at the older man standing beside him. Tatman has begun coughing. A fine red spray comes from his mouth each time he does it. One hand is on the knife in his neck, trying to pull it out. Blood pours down the side of his t-shirt and splatters his jeans. He begins walking toward the intersection of Commerce and Airline, where all traffic has stopped, still bent over and still coughing. With his free hand, he gives a jaunty little wave. Hi, Ma. Sanderson gets to his feet. His legs are trembling, but they hold him. He can hear sirens approaching. Sure, now the cops come. Now that it's all over. Sanderson puts an arm around his father's shoulders. You all right, Pop?
That man was beating on you, Pop says matter-of-factly. Who is he?
I don't know. Tears are coursing down Sanderson's cheeks. He wipes them away. Tatman falls on his knees. He has stopped coughing. Now he's making a low growling sound. Most people hang back, but a couple of brave souls go to him, wanting to help. Sanderson thinks Tatman is probably beyond it, but more power to them.
Did we eat yet, Reggie?
Yeah, Pop, we did. And I'm Dougie.
Reggie's dead. Didn't you tell me that?
Yeah, Pop.
That man was beating on you.
His father's face twists into the face of a child who is horribly tired and needs to go to bed.
I've got a headache. Let's blow this pop stand. I want to lie down.
We have to wait for the cops.
Why? What cops? Who is that guy?
Sanderson smells shit. His father has just dropped a load. Let's get you in the car, Pop. His father lets Sanderson lead him around the Subaru's crumpled snout. Pop says,
That was some Halloween, wasn't it?
Yeah, Pop, it was. He helps the 83-year-old caped crusader into the car and closes the door to keep the cool in. The first city police car is pulling up, and they want to see some ID. The 61-year-old boy wonder, hands pressed to his aching side, shuffles back to the driver's side to pick it up off the street.
For John Irving. As I said in the note to Batman and Robin, sometimes, once in a great while, you get the cup with the handle already attached. God, how I love that. You're just going about your business, thinking of nothing in particular, and then, kaboom, a story arrives, special delivery, perfect and complete. The only thing you have to do is transcribe it. I was in Florida, walking our dog on the beach. Because it was January and cold, I was the only one out there. Up ahead, I saw what looked like writing in the sand. When I got closer, I saw it was just a trick of sunlight and shadow. But writers' minds are junk heaps of odd information, and it made me think of an old quote from someone